Output. Welcome to Input Output. I'm Jeff Sanoff.
And I'm Eli Janney.
And we have a very special guest today, David Lowry.
Very special.
You might not know this about him, but he's a trained mathematician who has worked as a quant.
What is a quant exactly?
I intend to ask him shortly. but more importantly, he is one of the founding members of Camper Van Beethoven and Cracker, as well as having been a record label owner, and currently is a professor of economics at the University of Georgia.
He also writes a awesome blog called The Tricordist, and he had an interesting interaction with Emily White, the NPR intern who wrote about owning music but not paying for it. His response provoked a great deal of response itself on
the internet. A veritable poo storm.
A duty storm, as it were, of response, and so we got him on to talk to us about that today.
Hey, David. Welcome to Input Output. I'm Jeff Sanoff.
Hi, this is Eli James. That's
nice to meet you guys.
So how do you go from being a musician to being a quant?
It's basically what I did before I was a musician. I was a mathematician, and in those days, pretty much the math people were the computer people.
Okay, so you didn't crash the entire financial industry then?
I actually, if we had taken the other side of that trade, we would have been successful. We were probably on the good side of the trade, ultimately.
Okay, so in June of 2012, NPR intern Emily White wrote a little editorial about how she had 12,000 tracks in her collection, but she'd really only bought about a dozen albums. And you wrote a very lengthy and well-thought-out response. I thought it was well-thought-out. And it kind of took the internet by storm.
Yes. I have this little funny little blog called The Tricordist. Me and a few other artists, we write about artist rights issues. So we just put it on there, didn't think anything about it. And about 24 hours after I wrote that, somebody somewhere picked it up. And I'm not sure what happened, but it completely blew up. And it ended up with, like, you know, to where it was being read 500,000 times a day. And this went on for some time. And actually still, to this day, I'd say that letter gets read about 1,000 times a day. So it's become a piece of our internet shared cultural dialogue about compensating artists.
Do you have a copyright on that letter?
I imagine I do, because many people don't realize this, but copyright is an intrinsic right. It's a human right. Just as soon as you write something, you own it. What the Copyright Office does is register and enforce copyrights, but it's an intrinsic right. It's a human right.
So all you have to do is prove that you did it, and then it's done.
Yeah. So that's what I did, and there's a lot of talk about that letter. If you read the letter, it's actually very polite and nice. But things that people wrote after that were quite, I mean, it got crazy, man, you know?
I thought it was just
on both sides of the issue.
I thought it was really unfortunate, because I thought her honesty deserved an honest response.
I know. I mean, I was like, hey, you asked this question, I'm answering this question, this is what we need. And I tried to frame it in a way that was geared towards other things that we all agree on. Like, yes, we can get cheap coffee, but we choose to buy fair trade coffee where the workers are compensated fairly.
There is a certain generational element to this. I thought it was unfortunate that you kind of got accused of being Grandpa Simpson, which I didn't think you were in that specific. And then too, it's like, let's just attack the guy's bands, because you don't like his music, you don't want to listen to his argument, which is just height of sophistry. It has nothing to do with the issue, which is, how do we make a system that people get what they deserve?
She got all of her music by trading flash drives and stuff like that. So I'm actually not even really talking about the internet in that whole conversation. You know, it's just about the ethics of it and not the technology or the semantics or any of that stuff.
I think the more interesting thing is that this got a lot more coverage on the tech blogs, as Eli pointed out to me the other day, than it did on the music blogs, which you would think that musicians would be the natural people to like come to your defense, not to be like, yeah, it's cool, man. Go ahead, take my music.
Well, this is the thing that's pretty funny is actually the response is from musicians to me, at least privately. And if you see the tweets and stuff like that, overwhelmingly supportive, which is really interesting. You have a couple outliers who, like, for instance, Dave Allen from Gang of Four works at an advertising agency now, and he's their digital guru. So he's got his money and his whole being invested in this digital ecosystem. And so really what I found was that almost entirely from the tech blogosphere, they did not engage in an academic discussion. The entire thing was stuff like this. The constant whining by David Lowry, this isn't the first time, proves only that whether he knows it or not, he doesn't understand the internet and how people use it. Nobody dealt with the actual issue, which one makes me say, okay, they didn't read my letter, or two, they're not willing to engage in a serious conversation about this.
So let's have a serious conversation. Like, give us a sort of synopsis of your points.
Why is it that we value the pipes, the broadband connections, the smartphone, data plans, all of that stuff? We're willing to pay for the hardware, but we will not pay for the content. And if you look at that, the content is usually the part that is owned by small stakeholders. You know, 99% of the records that are out are either on indie labels or put out directly by small artists, right? And then the other two things, the hardware and the pipes, are these giant mega corporations. Since when is it cool to give your money to the giant mega corporations and say, hey, fuck you, little weirdo hippie freak musicians, we're not going to give you any money? That is totally counter-revolutionary. And not one person addressed that issue. And the entire tech blogosphere, the only thing that they could do was call people names.
Yeah.
That was a way of framing the question I had never come across before. I think we're in an era where the internet has made things so insanely convenient that it took very little time for us to all get used to having everything we want content-wise at our fingertips. And most people I know are not going to waste their time downloading large movies because it's just not a good use of my time. I'd rather spend the $2 on a movie than the 3 hours looking on Pirate's Bay for some movie. But music, the file sizes are so much smaller, it just makes it really easy. Maybe you could give us a little bit of a basic understanding of the economics. What they're actually making money from is you looking at their page and absorbing their advertising, right?
Oh yeah. Most, YouTube and any sort of file sharing pirate site, stuff like that, that has advertising, is making their money by getting eyeballs there to look at the ads. And so, yes, in a way, the viewer is the product, right? And they're doing all kinds of stuff like checking to see what other tabs you have open in your browser and throwing you ads based on that. They're also looking at where you've been, where you are physically located right now. So they're checking you out. They're seeing who you are, where you are, what you've visited, what other things you're looking at and stuff like that, and which artist or movie you're about to, pirate from one of these sites. So yes, it's a combination. You as a consumer and then myself as an artist were being exploited by, Fortune 500 companies. You know, they are making this possible. It's not cheap to have, a file sharing site like ForShared probably spends quite a bit of money on all of those servers that are storing all of their users' files, which are largely appear to be copyright infringing. So somebody somewhere has to pay for that. And one way they do it two ways. One way they do that is by monetizing it with advertising. And it's some of the biggest companies in the United States, in the world, are complicit in this. It's Microsoft, their ad networks. It's Yahoo's AdWorks. It's Google's ad networks. I'm not against technology. I'm just against our ethics that we've adopted with this technology. And if the artists have to adapt, so do the consumers. they have to adapt their thinking and their morality and their ethics to the new system.
So it's like a social good problem where like trying to get people to quit smoking or to not like litter, for instance. You know, you got to plant the seed that it's this kind of an issue. And then if you get a critical mass of people, it becomes socially unacceptable.
Yeah, there's actually a guy who wrote a whole book about that called Nudge, which is about how you just have to gently nudge people in the direction. It doesn't really take much to get people to change their ethics about things like that, like littering or smoking or for instance, file sharing.
Or wearing a helmet on your bike. I mean,
that's a helmet on your bike. Yeah, yeah, something like that, yeah.
A social good. So is it just going after the end user, the consumer, or educating them, or is there something on the business side that can be
done? Yeah, sure. You have the consumer. They've got to feel good about giving the money to musicians by paying for art. And so that's the carrot. And then it has to be sort of socially unacceptable to like download stuff. That has to be kind of uncool. And that's the stick. Now that's with the consumer. Now on the supply side.
So you're not actually asking for, just to clarify, I mean, on the consumer side, the stick part of it, I mean, other than just sort of moral opprobrium, there's not a lot of like, for instance, the RIAA suing kids for downloading.
Yes.
Yeah.
All it is on the consumer side, all it is just people going, dude, that's not cool.
Well, that's
actually much more powerful than people think it is.
I agree.
You're a hippie.
Yeah. Well, I am kind of a hippie, but I'm from California. But it is true that that is more powerful than you think it is.
I would say your letter is a pretty good evidence of the fact that it's more powerful than people think it is. I've seen a lot of people quibbling with some of your math or some of your specifics, but the core issue of should musicians get paid for their contributions? No one even attempts to refute that.
Right.
Except for one guy.
Who is that?
A friend of mine named Zach Barocas wrote a thing on his blog. He's a poet about how the idea that artists should just be doing art and not worry about money and that you don't do it to get rich. And I think that that's not really the argument. That to me is a sideline. Like you can argue about the choice to get paid or not. But I think if you want to get paid...
Well, he's free to do that.
Yeah.
Patton Oswalt had a great line. He came out at the 40 Watt Club and he apologized for being against gay marriage. And the crowd got kind of hushed. He goes, I'm sorry, I just didn't realize that it was optional. Okay. It was pretty funny. But anyway, so the whole thing about copyright, it's optional, dude. If you want to give your stuff away, give it away. Why make the rest of us give it away, you know?
Exactly.
Somebody's going to make money off of it. Why not let the artist make money off of it, you know? This is like the people who make that argument, you have to go back in time to like the 1930s. And here's the old bluesman, you know, in North Mississippi. He comes to meet the sort of the gangster slash business record executive from Memphis, right? And, you know, he gets $20 from his songs from the guy in Memphis, right? Well, the whole thing about this new ecosystem, you don't even get the $20, okay? You do not get the $20. This is the problem. If people don't want to make money off of their art, they don't have to. There's another argument in that realm, too, that people start talking about. They talk about how music could go back to a system of patrons.
But we've kind of done that anyway, because it's mostly people from families with money that can afford to stay in the game.
Essentially, that's what it is.
That actually is true. It's very, if you run a studio, you know that. It's like you're recording a lot of rich people now.
And we love them.
I was with David Byrne at the Smithsonian this week, and we did a little talk. And his book, some of it concerns money and music and stuff. And we started, and David started the talk with showing the decline in recorded music revenue. You know, a bunch of charts, and he had me bring some royalty statements and stuff like that. So in the question and answer period, a lot of people came up with complex ideas about how artists should make money, right? Well, but you can go on the road live and then blah, 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 and there's all this stuff. And they were quite long. And at the end of one of them, David Byrne says, or we could just pay artists for their recordings. It was funny. I mean, because every other explanation is really long and complicated. So paying artists for the recordings is the simplest way to do it. It's the most effective way to do it. And it's a market-based way to do this, which fits well with our society. We're a market-based economy. It fits very well with the way our society works. And it's the simplest and fairest way to compensate people. Let the people with the most popular stuff, let them get compensated, you know, the most.
Debating what furthers the art form, which is kind of what I think your argument with Jimi Hendrix or Mark or whoever is. I think that is one where maybe the free culture people that you were describing, maybe they kind of have a valid point in that the idea that openness creates more, not less, creativity and innovation is kind of an important way of looking
at it. But you can have openness with copyright right now. Why does everybody have to join their society? I have 4,000 songs on the Internet Archive. I put them there. We let our fans put them there. Anybody can cover any of our songs. There's all the sharing that's going on already. Look at hip hop. I mean, I always talk about Lawrence Lessig's books. In Lessig's books, he makes up all these emergencies that aren't actually emergencies, right? He proposes that we have this grand hybrid remix economy. We already have it. It's called hip hop.
Wait, what do you mean?
Could you elaborate? Because I'm not sure I totally follow your...
Well, a lot of the copy left or free culture people want to be able to take other people's music and remix and sort of create new things out of it, right?
Okay.
I say this is a fake emergency because ever since Sylvia Robinson, right there in, where are you guys, in Brooklyn?
Brooklyn!
Yeah, wasn't in Brooklyn. Rapper's Delight. She took, wasn't it Bernie Edwards and Nile Rodgers' track and kind of remixed it, hybridized it, and created new music, right? Within the current copyright regimen that we have right now. Hip hop is an example of the hybrid remix economy, and it works. And why does it work? Because everybody gets a fair share. The people whose songs that it was based on get a share of the songs. The new artists get a share of the revenue from those songs. It works right now. It's a fake emergency.
So Spotify versus Moog, are we arguing basically about who just gives a better royalty rate, or are that, there great?
And I think Spotify has to come clean on their transparency at some point so we can all decide. The good thing, I'll tell you this about Spotify. If you want to take your songs off Spotify, apparently they let you. I didn't even really intend to pick up the banner of Spotify. That is one sentence in both my Meet the New Boss, Worse Than the Old Boss, and Letter to Emily. There's one sentence basically about Spotify. I did not intend to pick up the banner against Spotify, but apparently they're hypersensitive and have their Google alerts set to stun. So I get a lot of, they took me to dinner and stuff like that to talk about their model and stuff like that. They're very nice people. And I've said to them, this is like a labor dispute. You know what I mean? Right. I think that artists need to be compensated more. And actually, if you give me a little time, I'll come up with if you give me some data, which they gave me, and if we can just figure out what the cannibalization rate is, like how much does Spotify replace sales, we could probably come up with what that number is if we work together. But I definitely think it's too low right now.
So conceptually, I think one fair question to ask is, are we attempting to take what was old, the old reward structure, figure out how to replace that?
I'm not arguing about the model. As a consumer, I love Spotify, and I think that's what people are going to do. They're going to pay for access rather than sales. Some people are still going to pay for sales. Some people are going to pay for access. But it has to be enough so that over a period of 3 or 4 years, you get enough money back that you can record the album. And I think you can look at it right now and look at the royalty rates that are being paid, and that ain't going to happen. Spotify does not pay based on spins. It has to do with the collective amount of spin that your label or your artist gets and the advertising revenue versus the premium subscription fees. It's really complicated. But yes, looking at very large catalogs, I've looked at 3 of them now. It's been working out lately to be about half a cent a spin, right?
And what would be fair?
With this premium subscription model, you get up to maybe about 2 cents with the royalty. Don't know. That's getting there, I'd say closer to 3 cents, really. And this is how I do it. I just go through my students' iTunes library and I look and see how many times they spin a song that they like a lot. And yeah, there's songs that they've spun 70 or 80 times in their iTunes library, but most songs that they like and they listen to are down in the 20 to 30 range. Just make that equivalent. Here's a song that you liked enough that you would buy it, basically, if you're spinning it 20 to 30 times, right?
That 20 times should equal $1.
Or I put it at actually 70 cents, but you get around 3 cents then if you do that.
I guess that to me is one of the core questions that I think is a difficult one to answer, because it's like, How do you figure out what a fair compensation rate is? I guess for a market-driven economy, it's whatever the consumer...
We don't know yet. I mean, and this is the problem with the whole internet economy, is that it doesn't really want to stay in a status quo very long. However, I will say this, though. Music digital ecosystem has been relatively stable for like 8 or 9 years. It is based on streaming, which includes YouTube and other legitimate services like, you know, Pandora, Rhapsody, and stuff like that, right? Yep. And there's also sort of illegitimate versions like Grooveshark and other things. And then there's file sharing. And then there's the white hats, you know, which are the main sort of digital stores like iTunes and Amazon and eMusic and stuff like that. That's remained really relatively stable since 2004. That's the tripod of digital distribution, are those three things. In the free file sharing side of it, there's always been two halves. There's been kind of the website ones and kind of the peer-to-peer BitTorrent-y ones.
Do you think like iTunes is paying a fair rate?
I hate beating up on iTunes, partly because they have really good reputation monitors, and I'll get like 50 emails after this, but no, they do. And they'll be on my Facebook page and stuff like that.
But
they have really good, but also because they're white hats. I see them as the good part of the ecosystem, but they basically take 30% of 80% of the digital download marketplace. Retail stores in the old days, when there was vinyl, breakage, stoned musicians, rent, air conditioning to pay to have a store to sell music, they, in theory, took 40%, but in practice, most of the time, because the rebates from the record companies, it was below 30% that they took. And here you have a purely digital store that, in theory, shouldn't have all those costs associated with physical stores taking 30%.
Well, they have big computers.
Yeah, well then, so is that a big lie? So the internet is not as efficient as we think it is?
I don't know.
I mean, did you see the contradiction there? If moving around physical CDs and product and having musicians and real estate and store hours and insurance and air conditioning and all of that stuff to run a store, if that is more efficient than all of Apple's server farms, we've taken a wrong turn somewhere.
Well, there's a lot of talk, you know, in the sort of green industry about how some of these data farms are really inefficient and the carbon footprint on them is very
centralized
high.
Server systems like that are really, really a waste of resources always, right? And this is an argument where a BitTorrent is way more efficient on bandwidth. It's possible somebody could do a legal BitTorrent type store and provide the service that iTunes or Spotify or these other services much better.
I think the other point that you made earlier, maybe we could touch on, is that it's not the problem that people aren't making money. People are making money, but it's just not musicians.
Yeah, there's sort of this notion that music is free now, and it's not actually true. Somebody inside BitTorrent told me they make like $2 million. The actual company BitTorrent, which actually only builds the software, the tools for creating BitTorrent systems, that just sort of their web browser plugin makes $2 million a month in advertising. I don't know if that's true, but that was a source close to the company told me that they thought the figure was about like that. Okay, so BitTorrent and CyberLocker sites make money from advertising and charging for premium, faster downloads, right? But none of that money goes to artists. Like Kim.com, he monetized every single musical file exchange. It's just that the money did not go to the artists. That's what's wrong with the ecosystem, is people are still making money off of the music. It's just none of it, or too small of an amount, is going to the artists. A much smaller amount than went to artists under the bad old record label system. And so how did we get here? This is crazy, right? And the other thing about CyberLockers, people tend to think of file sharing as being like sort of teenagers spreading one file to another. And so, and some of it is. But about 16% of the internet traffic is CyberLockers and some sort of BitTorrent activity. And most of that is run by very small interrelated groups of people that are based in places like Cyprus, Moldova, Belarus, and a few other sort of places that it's hard for us to get to them. when I look at the relationships between all of these cyber lockers and how so many names and addresses and holding companies are all involved in these things and they're all related, to me, it's really reasonable to say that this is organized crime. That actually a lot of the cyber locker sites are basically operated by what most people would call the transnational Russian mafia.
It would be an interesting thing if you want to talk about the ethics of supporting that.
Well, yeah, especially because, for instance, you can tie Hotfile, which is one of these websites, you can tie them directly to this arms smuggling firm called Armitech. There are UN reports that this is the Russian mafia arms smuggling arm. Armitech. You can tie Armitech directly to Hotfile. Same people. And, you know, you're talking arming child soldiers here. So when you're using Hotfile, you're giving money to people who are arming child soldiers, as far as I can tell.
Well, aren't you doing that when you buy ExxonMobil gasoline in Nigeria?
Well, yes, probably too. But that's why all kind of liberal, you know, progressive thinking people are trying to wean ourselves away from stuff like that.
I mean, I think it's fascinating to think that that is a, it just seems like such a good way to approach talking about it, because I think everybody who responded to you would agree that if they could choose between giving their extra 30 cents to Apple or giving, you know, some basically advertising, and God knows what's on your computer after you go to those sites. So basically, we can just scare the Emily Whites of the world into not, you know, doing this. Because, Emily, we don't know what's on that USB stick, but it did stop an Iranian nuclear reactor the last time I checked.
Hey, so one of the promises of the new music economy model was that there was going to be a lot bigger pie. Each person might get a lot less, but there was going to be a lot more sales due to all these niche markets.
Chris Anderson, who I know, he's my bass player's boss at Wired, and he posited something called the long tail.
The long tail.
Basically, the future of selling is selling less of more things.
Yes.
So that part is basically more or less true. But one of the corollaries of that was that people thought there would be less blockbusters because there would be less big hits, because essentially they had so much competition from all of those small artists out there. Instead of 15,000 albums a year, 75,000 albums a year come out now. Well, basically this is one point where even Chris Anderson will back away from his predictions. Turns out we have just as many blockbusters. That the tail, the bottom 15,000 to 17,000 albums, do not compete with the big sellers in any measurable way. Big hit artists are still making, you know, big hits. Yes, they're selling less because the whole pie has gotten smaller. But the fact that there's 75,000 albums released a year as opposed to 15,000 released a year, there was already so much competition. Throwing in another 60,000 albums into
it's irrelevant.
Mix each
it doesn't
year
change the equation.
Really did not change anything, because the bottom 60,000 albums released a year sell on average 13 copies. Okay? They don't. It's basically friends and family. There's competition in live music, in live revenues, because most people didn't tour because it was a loss leader. Now they're trying to convert it into a profit-making thing. So we have four times as many shows as we did in, say, 1985. I don't remember which year it is, but it's four times as many from a sort of a pre-internet-y year. My wife is a concert promoter. She's done about 6,500 shows over the last, I don't know, 20 years or whatever. And you can actually look at what people were making, like a big pool of them. And she's gotten to the point where she's just like, you know, she runs the 40 watt and stuff like that. And there's, you know, a clear pattern. If you look at her records, she's gotten to the point where she's just like, well, if you want to play the 40 watt, here it is. I'll give you guys a really good door deal, but I won't guarantee any money up front, except for a couple exceptions, maybe a month. So that's where the competition has affected us. I don't think it's affected us in recorded music sales.
I wonder if the middle class, the sort of working musicians, the bands, like I think of Pavement as being the band that I always aspired to be in the sense of like, you know, they did okay. They weren't like huge, but they did well enough that they, you know, probably all had enough money to get by, had enough money to have families, you know, at a certain point, maybe they had to move on with their lives, whatever it was. But for the time that their band was the most active, they were doing okay.
I think Pavement is a good example of, yes, like a middle-class artist, I would say. And Cracker did have some big platinum hits, and that has produced, you know, a legacy of radio play to this day. But if we didn't have that, we would have been about on that same platform. And live-wise, you know, we're definitely in the same realm. They actually probably performed to more people than Cracker would in a lot of cities, right? So in a way, I feel like I'm part of that and I can speak about that fairly well. But regardless, just being married to somebody who's a concert promoter, I see how everybody lives, right? And what kind of money they make and stuff like that. So yes, the big middle class of the music business has been financially decimated in my view. And some of that had to do with the fact that part of what was paying the bills, part of what the middle class of musicians, how they were paying their bills was you'd come home from tour. There were some royalties that you got because your tour produced some sales. Mm-hmm. And you got home from tour and you could maybe spend 6 or 8 months at home and write a new album and record it and put it out before you went back on tour. That tale of recorded music sales that you get from touring has dropped off significantly. I don't want to put a number on it, but I'd guess half. But the main reason that middle-class artists are poor is because, and this is not obvious to everybody, is that the old record label system was kind of a risk and revenue sharing system where, you know, Ahmet Erdogan purportedly said, throw 10 records against the wall and see which one stuck, right?
Right.
He didn't actually say that as far as I could tell, but it's sort of urban legend. So the whole system was built on signing 10 bands, needing only one of them to hit. So what happens? Look at the other 9 bands that aren't successful. Even though, yes, they didn't have a hit, they got record advances. By the late 90s, you were getting like health insurance. You had a very middle-class job, even as an unsuccessful record label artist. You had a very middle-class job. And for the indies to compete, they were also doing similar things. Maybe they weren't paying as well. They weren't giving as big of advances. Maybe they didn't have as many other benefits that the major labels were giving. But they were still, you were still getting nice advances.
Well, like the touch and go or Discord models where you're getting 50% band label splits, where the distribution of what does come in is a lot fairer, even if the money up front isn't. So if you sell 20,000 records on Discord, you might actually make a few dollars.
But people discount how much money those advances were and how they supported the artist for those years. So that system, as weird as it was, sort of produced this artificial middle class of musicians. How it worked was you're sort of taking the winnings of the winners and just spreading it around among the other artists that weren't successful. So that was the vast middle class of artists was created by these advances. And then what you saw at the same time, you saw a lot of artists that said, well, no, we'll just bet on ourselves and we'll take this touch and go deal. We'll take this, you know, these other record deals, the merge records, you know, 50-50 profit split and stuff like that. You had artists doing that, but there was a lot who weren't. Now, most deals resemble those touch and go deals, those profit split deals. And I think actually that the impoverishment of the middle class of artists actually has as much to do with that there are no longer advances as piracy does. I'd say they're equal in weight. And a lot of people would be surprised I would say that. But it's just simply the business structure got different. We went from sort of a more socialist system to a highly winner-take-all libertarian sort of economy in the music business. And that produced more of the, as much of the effect as piracy did on the middle class of artists.
That's a compelling story, but you did just describe the old music business system as being socialist.
Yes, I do believe it was kind of a Sweden. Capitalist, but with lots of social safety nets
and lots of blonde women.
And that's what created that middle class of artists. And you know, that's not coming back, even with fairer compensation. I'm not sure that we get that level of a middle class of artists.
So what do you think are like the three biggest challenges facing artists as far as getting compensation? And what are your proposals?
Three challenges for artists.
You can pick a different number if you'd like.
Yeah.
Okay. The first challenge for artists is to get paid fairly in this new digital age. And there's streaming services like Pandora that now want, you know, supposedly they want to cut their rates 85%, the amount that they're paying to performers. They're gone to Congress basically to change the deal that they negotiated with our artist unions. I mean, when does that happen? They've gone around the unions, gone to Congress, and they basically want them to change the law so that they can pay artists supposedly 85% less than what they are. That's Pandora, okay? So this is our first challenge as artists, is to get web broadcasters and other people in the digital musical space to value our content. That is the number one thing. To me, the shape of the whole music business going forward, whether the United States has this great soft power through our cultural goods like music and songs, and that we have this vibrant artistic community, rests on us being compensated fairly. And so that's the number one challenge to me. The second challenge is for artists to convince our fans that they need to pay us. It's not Pirate Bay's job to do that. It's not the government's job to do that. It's not the Grammys' job to do that, although they could be more helpful. It's the artist's duty to engage the fans and explain this to them and to stop coddling the file-sharing, free culture, free hattest thing. I'm so tired of artists saying, man, that's so great that you said that. And I was like, well, you should speak out too. Oh no, our fans would hate that. They'd, you know, they'd hate that, right? The next challenge is for artists to stop being the usual pussies that we always are.
Yes, exactly. But what about the, you know, when Metallica was like, I mean, 10 years ago or something, when they came out and it sounded like they were supporting the RIAA suing downloaders, which it depends on how you say it, because you don't want to come across like those
guys. I don't think you want to go after fans. This is the whole point. My whole thing at the Tricord is what I'm writing about is to go after the institutions that enable the file sharing and the piracy,
and
not the actual end users. It's like prosecuting the street dealers instead of going after the drug lords.
Exactly.
Right? That's what Metallica, they just didn't get it. That's the second thing. The third thing is where some people on the tech side of things, I think, are correct. We sort of have to give people something other than an MP3. You know what I mean? And we have to figure out how to do that. We all have to sort of figure out another sort of enhanced version of what we do to sell to people. I mean, it's a little hard to sell an MP3 in this day and age of full-on platform gaming, you know, 3D gaming and stuff like that. And I don't mean necessarily artists. Record labels could be much more creative in all of this and help out artists a lot. So maybe that's what my third point is that's really record labels and artists together reimagine the experience.
That I completely agree with. I mean, I think the thing about Spotify is that it brings together such a large catalog and it makes it so easy that your $10 a month, it's well spent if you like what they give you. And then they have these apps. I mean, you know, Matador Records has a Matador app where you can listen to specifically Matador bands. So you have the access to the niche product if you want it, but then you can also just listen to whatever. You can listen to kids' music if you have a five-year-old like I do.
Yeah. And so, you know, these are simple solutions that if we just sort of get outside of the, you know, seeing your song as one line, 99 cents sold in iTunes, if you get sort of outside of these, you know, constructions that are going on, there is money laying around for artists to get, but we have to go and get it, and we have to educate our fans. It's a lot about educating the fans.
Yeah, that's true. And it's also, I mean, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the old big corporate to record labels, but one thing that they did do that musicians are terrible at is marketing this stuff. You know, you can't imagine Kurt Cobain selling himself on Twitter.
Yes, exactly. I mean, that say what you will about the old system, but our specialty is making music and recording. What other society is going to make the specialists in that also the print t-shirts and sell those, and then also market to magazines. Specialization was a good thing. It's why we don't live in trees and wear animal skins anymore.
I kind of do that.
Yeah, speak for yourself.
Brooklyn's got a few trees, so you can do that here.
Well, I mean, outside of the studio.
Yeah. But, All right. Outside of a Ted Nugent concert.
Yeah. Well, I'm just saying. I mean, like, why are we supposed to go backwards and not specialize, you know?
It's funny that you say that. I basically agree with you, but I also remember the 90s when people were basically on the whole DIY ethic of, well, I don't want a record label. I want to do all those things myself. And the truth is, me personally, when I was in a band, I didn't want to like call.
Well, see, Camper Van Beethoven had done that in the 80s. And so we were over it by the time, you know, I was in the 90s. We had done that, you know, and it was like there were some advantages to it. You know, first of all, our records would have never come out. I mean, nobody was interested in a band like Camper Van Beethoven, whether it was in there were punk rock labels and there were basically major labels and there was nothing in between. Nobody would have put that out. So we had to do it ourselves. And that's the great thing about the digital world is you no longer have the artistic gatekeeper, but now you have the payment gatekeepers.
Yeah, yeah, but I need a gatekeeper. I mean, I'm, you know, there's so many bands and so much music out there. I need some, I kind of need some help.
Yeah, well, no, not only that is that that's BS that there's no gatekeepers. I mean, go put your video on YouTube and see how many views it gets. You know, obscure band out of nowhere. You're not going to get your video promoted until somebody like Pitchfork picks it up, which is a gatekeeper.
True.
Pitchfork, yes, Under the Radar, or Daytrotter, or somebody somewhere that is essentially a cultural gatekeeper now.
Yes, you do.
Picks it up. It's just now we have snarky gatekeepers.
Yeah, but this generation has chosen them as their gatekeepers. They kind of assign them. And I think each group maybe has their own. I don't know.
Yeah. And that's a kind of value that also actually artists have always possessed. And maybe we should figure out how to monetize that. 50 Cent brings up the game. And, you know, he's sort of the gatekeeper for this sort of gangster rap sort of subgenre, you know, right? And you know, he's compensated as a result of that, really, essentially. Like the drive-by truckers taking Alabama Shakes out on tour, right?
In some ways, I think the hip-hop example is actually a better one in that context because there is a lot of fucking competition within bands, as you well know. Like every band is sort of like their friends, but then are they really promoting their friends or are they not promoting their friends? And the hip-hop thing is because I think there's a more clear-cut financial investment in the guy that you're bringing up. Because you're going to probably get paid out of that. You are out there promoting it. And you want to be the next Puff Daddy who got his own career off the ground. And now he owns, you know, a hell of a lot of other bands as well. Maybe a level of the middle class in me is a little bit put off by the, I don't know, it's sort of like you go to Brighton Beach too. It's just kind of garish.
Well, that's okay. But listen, that's a longstanding cultural bias. Can you imagine some hip hop artists like going, dude, man, I don't do this for the money. I mean, this is that whole thing about artists shouldn't make money is a total Western middle class construction.
It's a weird
that nobody else
thing. I totally agree.
Shit about.
It's true. It's
yeah,
totally
you know
true.
What I mean?
Especially coming from DC, where we have that puritanical. No, I mean, I believe in music as an art form first and foremost. But I think it's ridiculous to think that musicians are just going to survive magically without, you know, monetizing what they're doing, especially when there is all this money flowing around. I think it's important that we get compensated for our work. Right, bitches?
Yeah.
Come on, exactly. Back me up, bitch.
Well, you don't have to be a rapitalist, you know?
Oh, yeah, that's right. Rapitalist. Yeah. That's a good one.
Ever since Jay-Z started selling those Occupy Wall Street t-shirts, I'm like, that guy's a rapitalist. He is not, he doesn't care about, you know, he just wants to get his, and he has done very well doing that.
He's gotten his a lot.
So, well, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure to talk with you, and I'm glad we got so much clarification on your work.
People well, thank
in the
you.
Listening world will have a new appreciation. I hope they will, at least.
Yep. Thank you very much. David Lowry is a lecturer at University of Georgia in the Music Business Program. He's also a trained mathematician who's worked as a quant and has played in a boatload of bands. Including Camper Van Beethoven and
Cracker.
Thank you so much for coming on and talking to us today. This is Input Output. I'm Eli Janney.
No, you're Sheila Janney.
I just said off.
exactly one.